What is God looking for? That's really the fundamental question. Each week, the church provides us with a set of readings, and there is a link between them. There's a logical thread behind them that is meant to answer that very basic question. What is God looking for? And so today, we're presented with the story of Naaman and the story of the lepers. So obviously, between the two of them, there's some sort of example that's being proposed to us to be edified by, or at least to imitate. So for a starting point, to me, it seems like where the attention is meant to go is where in the gospel it says, "And one of them, realizing he had been healed, returned glorifying God in a loud voice. And he fell at the feet of Jesus and thanked him." Ah, maybe that's what God wants, right? We had a whole week filled with blessings, more than we could count, most of which we couldn't even perceive. Maybe God's like, could I get a little gratitude? I mean, even Jesus himself will say, has none but this foreigner returned to give thanks to God? But something about that, I don't know about you, it just seems to really fall short. God's always doing more than just like, hey, could you like say thanks? At least write me a card. So I did what any of you would have done. I pulled out my Greek translation of the New Testament, and I began wondering what it actually says. And I realized this translation that we heard today is really not that helpful, because there's more going on. That line, he fell at the feet of Jesus and thanked him, it literally says he fell on his face at Jesus' feet and offered him Eucharist. Fell on his face, offered him Eucharist. And then Jesus, does he say, did none but this foreigner come to give thanks? No, he doesn't. He says, were there none found who returned to worship God except this foreigner? That changes things, doesn't it? Consider Naaman, for example. He's a Syrian officer. He's not a Jew. That's the whole point. He's a Syrian officer. He's not into the whole like Moses, Torah, temple worship, yada yada, bar mitzvah, never been to one. So when he gets healed by this Jewish prophet, Elisha, or God through the prophet, he says to him, let me take 2 mules worth loads of soil. And he says, for I will no longer offer a holocaust or sacrifice to any other god except the Lord. And with this soil, he's going to do it on the Holy Land, even though he's living in Syria. In other words, what's really being put forward is that what God wants, he wants worship. Again, God's mercy on these people certainly satisfies their needs. The lepers, they just wanted to be cleaned. Naaman, he just wanted to live because he had leprosy too. And God does this for them. But as is so typical of him, he far exceeds what they're asking for. And he restores them not just to their communities and their places of work, their families, but the most important thing he does for them on that day is he restores them to a right relationship with himself so that they could worship him. Now, that I have to admit, that sounds a little selfish, right? Like, oh, okay, so you're doing this so that we could all fall on our face and bow before you, you know? And besides, who doesn't want a little worship? Even Father Cox has the altar servers refer to him as my Lord. But if you think about what happens when we worship God, is glory isn't really actually added to him. He has it before any of us exist. When we worship him, the work that he really wants to do in our life is finally possible. So he's actually doing this again for us. It's the abundance of his mercy pouring forth so that we may have life not just in this life, but in the next, and to possess it in a manner that far exceeds our nature and our capacity to even imagine it. Which is why that one Samaritan that returns to Jesus receives far more than the other nine who were also healed. Because to this one alone who fell on his face and offered him Eucharist, Jesus says to him, "Your faith has saved you." That's the work of God. And it was only accomplished in 10% of the group that he desired to give it to. Now, that's not to undermine the seriousness of leprosy. Leprosy is no joke. I mean, according to WebMD, which at least twice a year diagnoses me with a terminal illness, leprosy leads to things like blindness, disfiguration of the face, kidney failure, muscle weakness that leads to claw-like hands and stubby feet, permanent damage to the inside of the nose, permanent damage to the nerves, including arms, legs, and feet, and through its complications, death. So what Jesus does for these men is no small thing. And leprosy is so serious that for physical material reasons, it is in fact keeping people from the temple and from worship. And so to restore them to health is to invite them back into that worship, which he does purely on a physical level. Just that alone makes that possible. The people on their part were so afraid of them, that's why they couldn't worship. Because could you imagine like sitting in a pew next to somebody who's literally decaying? You would be terrified. And they also didn't know whether it was contagious. But the greatest obstacle to worship, leprosy? Not really. I mean, these spaces in the pews, is that how many lepers we have in Havertown? There is an obstacle that is greater to worship than leprosy, and one that is far nastier. And it's called sin. But the problem with that word sin kind of lost its meaning, right? Like, oh, sin, right, that Catholic guilt thing. That's a sin. Oh, okay. We don't really appreciate it, but I'd like to reclaim an appreciation of it by example. And there's no greater example that I can think of than Catherine of Siena, who had a blessing or a curse, whatever you want to call it. She could smell the stench of sin. And for her, it smelled like decay. It's a spiritual leprosy. There's something fitting here. And on this particular occasion, this very distinguished woman comes to visit her. She's all well presented, very dignified, very respectable, and presents in a very godly manner, to the point that even Catherine of Siena's spiritual director, Father Raimondo, is very edified. Meanwhile, while the woman is talking to Catherine, she just can't look straight at her. And it was so blatantly impolite that the priest finally said to her, "What are you doing?" And he chastised her for acting so impolitely, bordering on lacking charity. And she says to him, "If you had smelled the stink of her sins, you would have done the same." So the priest, curious about what this could mean, did a little investigating about who this woman was, and it turns out she was a prostitute who was living as a concubine with a priest. And Catherine of Siena could smell it. She looked at the Holy Father one time in the face and said to him that she could smell the stench of sin coming from the Roman court all the way from her hometown in Siena. And if you want to know how far that is, that's 146 miles. I couldn't smell McDonald's from that far. But she knew everybody's business that was going on in Rome because it stunk, which tells us there is something about the quality of sin that alters our being. We reek, and it disfigures our person the way that leprosy disfigures our body. And all of this, Jesus washes away, if we ask him to, in the sacrament of reconciliation. Because in that box, we're not just healed. Our stench isn't just turned into the odor of sanctity, but we are made fitting to offer God Eucharist, which is the very locus of God's primary work in our life. So, what does God want? Well, he wants our worship. He wants our Eucharist, so that he could give us more than we could ever even ask for. But to do that, we have to be made clean. We have to let him clean us in the sacrament. But he's only going to do that if we ask.